Welcome to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe. With me is In Context military affairs commentator, Marshawn McDermott Rowe.
Great to be here.
A military invasion of a country is the ultimate act of war. In today's War Report, we're going to examine many aspects of this phenomena. We'll start with a brief look at the U.S. experience with military invasion. Then we'll discuss some basic questions about invasions. For example, why do countries invade each other? Why are some invasions successful while others fail? What is the best way to deter or defeat an invasion? And finally, we'll consider what the answers to these critical questions imply for the defense policy of the United States. Marshawn, let's start with the American experience of invasion. When was the last time that the United States was invaded, and what were the circumstances?
You know, a lot of people talk about the last time the U.S. was invaded, quote-unquote, was during World War II, when the Japanese seized the Aleutian Islands off the coast of, or a couple of the Aleutian Islands off the coast of Alaska, and they say that was really the last U.S. invasion of U.S. soil. But in all fairness, the last true invasion was the War of 1812, because I exclude from this the Mexican-American War, which really was our invasion of Mexico, not vice versa. And I exclude also the Civil War, because civil wars don't necessarily constitute an invasion, unless, of course, the division has been established, like North Korea and South Korea, and then one side invades the other. The American Civil War was a civil war. There weren't established borders yet.
And, of course, the War of 1812 was a war with Great Britain. It took place during the Napoleonic Wars. That's what was going on in Europe. And it lasted for 3 years. What was the impact on the United States?
It was a humbling experience, because what most people aren't aware of is that it was a war of aggression on the part of the United States. And I know growing up in the 90s, and I'm sure for folks growing up before the 90s, the War of 1812 was always seen as a defensive war, the British invading, burning Washington, seizing our sailors on the high seas. What the War of 1812 was really about was the United States wanting to annex Canada. Now, originally, President Madison and Thomas Jefferson opposed the invasion of Canada. But at the time, the central government, we tend to think nowadays that the president has all power, you know, overall overseeing power, executive privilege. Back in 1812, the president didn't have that. The president didn't have the authority by himself to invade a country or declare war. So when Congress decided we're going to invade and the general said, yeah, you know, we'll annex Canada, this will be a cakewalk, Madison and Jefferson were opposed to it. By the time war broke out, it was really too late to do anything.
They called it Mr. Madison's War. But the invasions of Canada were not successful. We went into Canada, and amongst the other things we did was to burn York, the city of York, which is now Toronto. And that led to reprisals by the British.
That's the reason the British burned D.C. It wasn't just an act of wanton aggression. It was in retaliation. The thing that surprised the Americans was the American army was not, for all intents and purposes, it was not a professional army. You had a few handful professional soldiers who were often underpaid, under-equipped, and under-trained, and many of the officers were underqualified for the position. And so they called up all these militiamen, many of whom had no formal military training, and invaded Canada. The Canadian army was very small, but what was shocking was how effective they were. And this is a case where we see training and discipline ultimately outweighs numbers, because we came into Canada with the numbers, but the Canadian Army had the training and discipline. They were British regulars.
So the War of 1812 really teaches some lessons about how to repel an invasion, in this case, an invasion by the United States of Canada. We, of course, were ultimately successful in the war at the Battle of New Orleans. We were invaded, of course, as you noted. Washington was burned. Baltimore was attacked. New Orleans was attacked. But ultimately, in 1815, we did prevail. What was the long-term effect on the mentality of the United States as a result of being invaded during the War of 1812?
It created, in a sense, a fear, a perpetual fear of invasion from the outside, kind of like the collective scar, you could say, that was left on the Russian people from the Mongol invasion, or indeed left on the German people from the Russian invasion, or the British people from the various wars they've had and attempted invasions of Britain. For the Americans, it left a perpetual fear of non-defended borders.
How long did that fear last? Because one doesn't see too much of it today.
Well, really, I think you saw it up through when the United States defeated the Indian tribes and annexed everything to the West, everything from New York to California. And the reason you had that annexation, in my opinion, was largely because of the scar of the War of 1812. We have to remember that during the war, the Indians predominantly allied themselves with the British. The British had a lot of armies in places like Ohio. It got the American people to desire security and conquest for the sake of security.
Well, a lot of that war took place at sea. It had to do with the coastal warfare, both with our own Navy and with privateers. Did it result in a fear that our coastlines were vulnerable?
Absolutely. That's when you saw a massive investment in the Navy. That's also when you saw the emergence of a professional U.S. Army. The Brits wiped the floor with our army, and the reason was because we didn't have professional soldiers. So it was after the War of 1812, you saw the emergence of a professional army. And really, ultimately, at the end of the day, what saved us was the fact that the British were more concerned with fighting Napoleon than they were with fighting us. Because realistically speaking, if Britain was able to throw its entire military weight against the United States, we would have been crushed.
Well, did this fear of invasion resulting from the War of 1812, was it reflected in the way Americans behaved in the 20th century in World War I and World War II?
Absolutely. Again, fear of invasion. That's what was played up. And indeed, one could even say that you see it in the modern psyche of the American people with the fear that, you know, if we don't fight them over there, we'll have to fight them over here. That's all part of that collective scar. That's why the constant theme up until 1991 was the Soviets are going to invade, the Nazis are going to invade, the Kaiser is going to invade, the Japanese are going to invade. It was that perpetual fear that somebody's going to land troops here. And even though that hasn't happened since 1812, it was a rallying cry. Then we saw a change after the fall of the Soviet Union when we felt we were omnipotent. For the first time, we didn't have any rival. And that's almost when you saw that fear pretty much start to dissipate. I mean, you had, after 2001, the fear of terrorism. Terrorists are going to invade, but it's still not quite the same.
Before we get into some of the general principles regarding invasions, let's define what an invasion is.
Well, an invasion is when one sovereign nation seeks to annex or through force coerce another nation into giving up parts of its territory.
So, for example, in World War II, you would call the invasion of Germany an invasion, but the progress across France you would not call an invasion?
No, because we were nominally going in with the support of the French government or the Free French government. I mean, you had the Vichy French government as well, but we were supporting another French government. It's also the end objectives. Our objectives was not to take Paris, raise the American flag, and declare Paris a territory of the United States or an occupied territory. Our goal was we marched into Paris, we restored a French government, and then we went up and invaded Germany. The difference you see, though, with the invasion of Germany is that we deposed the government, we executed its leaders and those who didn't commit suicide, its generals, and we also kept an army there.
Now, an invasion would not include, say, a coup d'etat, such as we did in 1953 in Iran when we removed Mossadegh.
No, that's where you get into asymmetric warfare using sabotage, covert ops, espionage. That Sun Tzu was a very big fan of those kind of tactics, espionage and covert operations. But no, you wouldn't necessarily count that as an invasion because, again, you're not talking about an occupation. When we overthrew Mossadegh, we put back in the Shah, who for all intents and purposes was still an Iranian.
Now, why do countries invade each other?
From the Battle of Kadesh in ancient Egypt to Caesar's conquest of Gaul to the Anglo-Afghan War, the Crimean War, World War I, World War II, and one could even argue the 1991 Gulf War, as well as the invasion of Iraq, so on and so forth, and the Russian invasion of Georgia. All of it, you can see, was for one of a handful of reasons. Resources, which include natural resources, oil, gold, silver, in some cases, women even, because when you look at often some nations like China, in more recent history, one of the problems they have is not having enough women. So they've looked at the prospect of occupying or invading their neighbors just so they can obtain women, because otherwise they as a people will go extinct. Living space, Lebensraum, as the Germans talked about. You also see wars to establish dominance, not necessarily to occupy, but to establish dominance.
Say to control key trade route.
Exactly, to control trade routes. And this might not even involve an invasion of the mainland. During the Crimean War, the goal was not to march the British army to Moscow. It was to occupy the Crimean Peninsula and then to deprive the Russians of access to the Mediterranean through the Dardanelles Straits.
Well, let's look at what makes an invasion successful. One of the more successful invasions in modern history was the Allied invasion of Germany at the end of World War II. Why was it successful?
Well, I think one of the things you have to do is look at the Allied invasion of Germany juxtaposed the German invasion of Russia. What you had happening during the Allied invasion of Germany was the Germans were fighting a two-front war. And you saw, on the one hand, you had the Americans who were coming in with the help of the British and the French with a tremendous amount of firepower. On the other hand, you had the Russians coming in with millions of men. They committed 2 million men to the Battle of Berlin, which the Battle of Berlin was not just for the city proper. It really begins with the fall of Warsaw and, you know, the Battle of the Oder-Neisse and the Zalo Heights and so on and so forth. So when you look at this invasion, you see that the Germans are stretched out tremendously. Hitler also made some very bad decisions. It would have been possible for Hitler to have held the Allies off for a considerable length of time, like the Germans had in World War I, if Hitler had evacuated Vienna and held the Rhine, said, you know, I'm going to take my 100,000 men out of Vienna, I'm going to put them on the Rhine. I'm going to take my 100,000, 200,000 men out of Prague, and I'm going to put them on the Zalo Heights. The Russians and the Americans and the British and the French would have been stopped for a considerable length of time. Might have been permanent, might not have been, but it would have given the Germans possibly enough time to obtain the atomic bomb, which they were very close to.
What happened to those troops that were left in Vienna and Prague?
They ended up getting surrounded and having to surrender. So you do see, on the one hand, bad leadership, a man with very little military experience interfering with his generals. On the other hand, you also see the fact that Germany could not divvy up its resources well enough. Now, you juxtapose that with, let's say, the German invasion of Russia, and what you see is the Soviets were only fighting on one front. They were not worried about the Japanese. I mean, there was a concern, but they had beaten the Japanese in Mongolia. So they had demonstrated to the Japanese that the Red Army was not something to be toyed with. Crucially, also, Stalin left his generals to do the fighting. He did interfere. He kept his generals kind of like leashed dogs. You know, he would let one get a little bit ahead, stop him, let the other one get a little bit ahead. But fundamentally, he was able to focus all of his resources on one front. And then, of course, he was getting supplied directly from the United States, whereas on the other hand, the Germans had no one supplying them.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe about military invasions, how they occur, and how a country like the United States could deter or defeat an invasion. In Context website is incontextreport.com, and you can also check us out on Facebook and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. Contrast the siege of Stalingrad with the siege of Berlin.
When Caesar surrounded Vercingetorix at Alesia, we still see the same principle from Alesia to Stalingrad and Berlin. At Stalingrad, the Russians were able to hold on to one side of the Volga, and they held a small beachhead in the city of Stalingrad proper. So they were able to keep resupplying and keep throwing troops in the fight. Additionally, Hitler made a strategic mistake. He sent his panzer units into the city itself and left the Romanians to guard the flanks. Well, the Romanians weren't as well trained and weren't nearly as well equipped, and the Italians either. So Zhukov, Marshal Zhukov, sends his cavalry around to sweep the flank of the Germans, and he does it successfully. And he ends up surrounding the Germans in Stalingrad. And now the besiegers become the besieged. So now they're fighting the Russians on the outside. They're fighting the Russians inside the city. And then, of course, you have what the Germans termed Rattenkrieg, which means rat war, war of the rats, rat war, because it was fighting in the sewers, fighting in the subway tunnels, fighting in the buildings, house to house, window to window, etc. That added to the brutality of the fight, but really the Germans were surrounded. Now, when you look at the Battle of Berlin, once the Germans had been surrounded Stalingrad, the fight was over. The Germans had to break the siege, and unfortunately, they sent their other army down to the Caucasus to seize the oil fields, and they ran out of gas. And they weren't able to turn around quickly enough to go liberate Stalingrad. Had they been outside Stalingrad, they would have broken the siege and the Germans would have won. So now you look at the Battle of Berlin. Once the Zalo Heights fall, you have Marshal Zhukov's first Belarusian front and Marshal Konev's first Ukrainian front sweep in and envelop the city. So the city becomes surrounded. And Hitler calls on General Wenck and General Steiner to come in and liberate the city, to break the siege. Because if the siege could be broken, if there could be a hole made in the Russian encirclement, the Berlin could have held out much longer, might have even held out for the duration of the war.
Maybe in time to make a separate peace with the United States, which was the Germans' hope.
That was their hope, exactly. And the Soviets committed somewhere between 1.5 to 2 million men. They lost from the Battle of Warsaw up until the fall of Berlin. They lost something like nearly 500,000 men. Urban fighting is brutal, and that's where you need numbers. The only way a defender in an urban setting can win an urban battle is through a war of attrition. Now, one thing I would like to point out is, again, you juxtapose this to the Battle of Sadr City, which were numerous small battles.
And we're talking in Iraq?
In Iraq, after the 2003 U.S. invasion. And the reason why Sadr was able to hold on to the city and keep the Americans out was the Americans could not successfully envelop the city because they didn't have the numbers. The Americans also were not willing to commit the number of troops or risk the number of casualties necessary to take control of Sadr City.
Whereas the Russians were willing to take a lot of casualties.
Exactly. And that's where also you see the difference. What makes a successful defense preventing an invasion versus a successful offense? An invasion is always going to be costly, and you will not be successful unless you acknowledge the fact, especially in an urban setting, that you're going to take a lot of casualties. Either you inundate them with men and take a lot of casualties and win, or you pull your punches and allow the defender to hold on to the city.
Well, let's look at two other modern wars that have important lessons regarding invasions, the Arab-Israeli wars of 1967 and 1973. Now, Marshawn, could you talk about these two wars and, in particular, discuss the importance of factors such as surprise, air power, and command and control in connection with invasions?
Well, one of the things you look at, and this is really the best example of a modern war with two relatively evenly matched armies. I mean, the Israelis were actually pretty outgunned, but technologically speaking, they were relatively evenly matched with the Arabs. In 67, the Israelis knew that they could not take on the Egyptians and the Syrians at the exact same time. So they had to deal a death blow to one and then the death blow to the other. So they knew the Egyptians were the strongest military force. So what they did is they knocked out, in a surprise attack, they knocked out the Egyptian command and control systems. They knocked out the military communications. They knocked out the air force on the ground. And the key is that even if you just knock out the air force and you obtain air superiority, as long as the enemy can still communicate with their troops, they can hold out. What the Israelis acknowledged was that if we can knock out their ability to communicate with their forces, we can overwhelm them. Because the Egyptians, like many armies, their commanders don't operate independently. And you can see that also with the U.S. Army. The Egyptian commanders had to wait for orders from Nasser to act. So once the communications networks were knocked out, the generals stood there and they couldn't take the initiative and act of their own will.
This is consistent with the Israeli attack on the U.S. Navy ship, the Liberty, in the 1967 war, which was essentially a surveillance ship that the United States sent and was in international waters monitoring the situation, and was attacked savagely by the Israelis and very nearly sunk with many U.S. sailors killed.
Well, the goal of the Israelis, though they still deny it, it's obvious to anyone looking at it impartially, that the goal of the Israelis was to sink the ship because the ship was monitoring all communications going through the region for the purpose of discovering whether Russian pilots were flying Egyptian planes. Well, the Israelis wanted to violate the UN-brokered peace accord and seize the strategic Golan Heights, which belonged to Syria. Well, if we heard that that was happening, they were afraid that the United States might inform the UN and that the Israelis would be forced to stop, that they would receive international condemnation before they had a chance to launch the attack. So attacking the Liberty and sinking it meant that, A, they could blame the Egyptians, possibly bring the U.S. into the war on their side, and at the same time seize the Golan Heights. Well, the problem is for them, the ship didn't sink. It survived. But they did disable the communications on the ship, at least, so they were able to seize the Golan Heights. So by the time anybody realized that they'd violated the UN peace accord, they'd already gotten the Golan Heights.
Now, command and control is particularly vulnerable in the modern era because we rely so much on high technology like GPSs and cell phones and things like that.
That's a huge problem that the United States military suffers from at this point in time because we haven't fought an army of equal strength. Now, the Israelis have acknowledged for a very long time the vulnerabilities of things like GPS. That's why they still teach their soldiers to read maps and things like that, is because they know that all it takes is an airplane or a submarine with a ballistic missile, or land-launched ballistic missiles, or, you know, somebody knocking out the satellites, or an EMP attack, electromagnetic pulse, which would fry their communications, fry electronics, and they would have to operate in the old-fashioned way. That's why the
And this could be delivered, the EMP, if I could interrupt for a second, can be delivered, what, from a submarine, a submerged submarine? It would be via missile exploded in the atmosphere above a country?
It could be delivered by a submarine. It could be delivered by a land-based missile. It could be delivered by satellite, even. The modern first strike weapon. It makes nuclear weapons redundant.
So because it immobilizes all devices that rely on electronics.
Everything, including your car. It's just everything that relies on electronics. The electromagnetic pulse bomb shoots down a very, very strong electronic pulse. And this sends a shockwave. If you imagine the reason why we have surge protectors, if you think about that, the reason why we have surge protectors is because when the power goes out, an electronic surge is sent through the entire grid, which can overload and fry all of your electronics. Well, if you imagine that coming down from above in the form of a bomb, it sends down something 10 times as powerful. Your surge protectors won't stop this. And it sends a electronic tamponade, if you will, through the entire grid. And this massive pulse goes through every outlet, into anything that holds electricity. It's drawn like a magnet. And it just overloads it with so much electricity, the thing overloads, overheats, and fries.
So now you're the
even if it's off.
You're the country being invaded and you get hit with one of these. Now your leadership can't communicate with anybody.
And that gives you the first major advantage. And that's what the Israelis sought to do with their surprise attack in 67. The idea is if you knock out your enemy's communications, they won't realize they're getting attacked until it's too late. And then reorganizing a counterattack, because the best way to stop an invasion is like the Soviets did. Their armies were falling back. Then they reorganized a counterattack at Stalingrad and began driving the Germans back. The whole idea of a first strike to eliminate your enemy's command and control is to not allow them the opportunity to reorganize a counterattack. Now, in this era where we don't have wind-up radios anymore, we don't have landlines with hard wires very much anymore, and even the ones we do aren't protected against EMP attacks. The only two facilities protected against EMP attacks are the White House and the Pentagon, which means they can communicate with each other, but with bugger all in the rest of the United States.
Troops could be out there in the middle of nowhere. They wouldn't know where they were going.
Exactly. They wouldn't know where the attack was coming from, if the attack was coming. They wouldn't know why their generators aren't working. And then, of course, the airplanes, unless they're in hardened bunkers, can't take off because their electronics are fried.
Now, let's look, if we could, for a moment at the 73 war, which the shoe was on the other foot. The Arabs attacked by surprise this time. And that has an important lesson regarding the significance of your air defense artillery.
And that's where now a country with a weak air force but a strong surface-to-air defense, air defense artillery system, can defeat a army with a much stronger air force. In the case of the Egyptians, their air force never recovered from the 67 war. So what they did is they invested very heavily in these Soviet surface-to-air missile systems. And what they did is when they crossed the Sinai, they knew the Israelis were going to counterattack. They knew that the Israelis would send in a massive wave of fighter bombers and they would try to dislodge the Egyptians from Sinai. Well, they had a Iron Dome, if you will, of surface-to-air missile systems.
And these are the Egyptians.
And so when the Israeli Air Force flew in, they got annihilated. They were knocked out of the sky. And then when it came down to man-to-man with the Egyptians had more people. And they were, by this point, pretty well trained. They had Sager anti-tank weapons. They had RPG-7s. I mean, they dealt a severe blow to the Israelis. And I saw an interview with Ariel Sharon, who was a tank commander during the 73 war. And he said that he ran into a young officer who was with a retreating column of Israelis who said, you know, we can't stop them. We can't stop the Egyptians. And the only reason the Egyptians lost that war was because they saw that the Syrians were actually losing. The Syrians launched an attack simultaneously in the north. Well, the Syrians...
These are the Egyptians' allies attacking Israel from the north.
Exactly. Yeah. The Syrians ended up getting beaten back. And so they started to say, look, we need support. We need you guys to launch a diversionary attack against the Israelis. And Sadat very foolishly sent his infantry and armored units outside the protection of that Iron Dome, at which point the Israeli Air Force just pulverized them. So the Egyptians, through their missile defense system, had the ability to fight a defensive war, to hold on, so long as they didn't leave the protection of that missile shield. The moment they left the protection, because the problem the Egyptians had is the Israeli Air Force was still intact. Now, you want to, let's say, compare this to if the U.S. were to bomb Iran. The Iranians now, if they were to fight, successfully go from fighting a defensive campaign to going on the offensive, Sun Tzu said the best defense is a good offense, they would have to knock out our air forces they flew in and then immediately launch a counterattack with either surface-to-surface ballistic missiles, or which the Egyptians didn't have, with surface-to-surface ballistic missiles like the Iskander, or with a submarine attacks, or with a massive air bombardment, knock out our air force while it was still on the ground.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe about military invasions, how they occur, and how a country like the United States could deter or defeat an invasion. In Context's website is incontextreport.com, and you can also check us out on Facebook and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. Let's take a look at another modern war. In 1980, Iraq invaded Iran. The war lasted 8 years and cost the lives of about 1 million soldiers and civilians. How did that war unfold, and what does the Iran-Iraq war tell us about factors in invasion such as geography, entrenchments and fortifications, and the training and the equipment of soldiers?
The geography plays a huge role, as well as does training and equipment. I mean, all of those factors play a huge role. One of the things you see with the Iran-Iraq war is the Iranians had a small air force. The Iraqis had a small air force. The Iraqis invaded Iran to seize the strategic oil wells along the border and secure the route to Baghdad at the same time. The Iraqis, who were much better trained, because by this stage, the Iranian army really hadn't recovered from the fall of the Shah.
The war starts with the invasion by Iraq of Iran, yes?
Yes.
In 1980, and they're crossing the desert, correct?
Yes, but most importantly, one of the things you see is that the Iraqi army is much better trained, much better led, whereas the Iranian army really hadn't recovered from the Iranian revolution. Most of the Shah's generals had either been executed or fled, so they didn't have the officer corps they used to have. They were mildly well equipped, but they weren't as well equipped. So the Iraqis meet with initial success. But what the Iranians did, which was very clever, the first thing they started to do is utilize the terrain. It begins to get very mountainous as you head deeper into Iran.
In the early going, the Iraq army swept across a flat area, desert, right?
Yes.
And so they didn't have too much geography to deal with.
They did have some urban centers, which held them up. Because what the Iranians did, which was very smart, is the first thing they did is they conceded territory. They said, oh, geez, they fell back and they began digging trenches. They built a massive defensive line. And so the first thing they did, what a lot of commanders make the mistake of doing, is they immediately try to break the enemy's momentum by attacking. Every war operates on the principle of momentum. If you're the attacker, you want to maintain the momentum all the way up to the enemy's capital. If you're the defender, you want to break the enemy's momentum and launch a counterattack. Well, so the first thing the Iranians did was they began building a line of trenches, and they made sure to break the siege on the cities that were surrounded by the Iraqis.
So the entrenchments were to protect cities.
Some of them, but a lot of them were just in the desert. But the idea was to protect the routes to Tehran to stop the Iraqis. And once these defensive networks have been set up, again, the Iraqis were also plagued by bad leadership on the part of Saddam, who was constantly interfering. So the Iranians built a massive defensive network of trenches. It really resembled World War I. They stopped the Iraqi army. But then the Iranians had the problem whereby they would counterattack, but they didn't have the numbers. But they didn't have the equipment or the training or the tanks to overpower the Iraqis. So it really bogged down into a stalemate, like I say, World War I style war. And the big problem, too, was that neither had the air capacity to knock out the other's command and control. So ultimately, the Iranians, even though they didn't have a strong officer corps, they were able to reorganize very quickly. And similarly, the Iranians didn't have the ability to knock out the Iraqi command and control, so the Iraqis were able to hold ground they'd taken. Now, if you look at the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, or the invasion in 1991, one of the first things the U.S. Air Force did was bomb the heck out of all of the Iraqi command and control networks, just flatten them, so this way we blinded the Iraqi army. Granted, that was a much more one-sided war, but the fundamental principle of blinding your enemy's army was still very strong.
So, for example, North Korea were to attack South Korea, where would they hit their command and control? What would they do to take that out?
Oh, the first thing they'd do is they'd hit Seoul. They would rely on blitzkrieg. If the North Koreans were to start unleashing a significant amount of artillery fire into Seoul, which Seoul is within artillery range, and they were to start
within
unleashing
artillery range of the
demilitarized
between,
zone. Yeah. And they were to start unleashing artillery fire onto the demilitarized zone, their tanks were to sweep across. The key for them would be speed, because the South Koreans, especially if they pummeled Seoul, the South Korean army would have difficulty responding because their command and control headquarters, their capital, is getting pummeled. So they're going to be paralyzed for a period of time, maybe 24 hours, maybe 48 hours, but that might give the North Koreans enough time to take Seoul. And then if they can keep the momentum going, the amount of time it would take the United States to reorganize and ship in 500,000 men to stop them, the time it would take the South Koreans to reorganize to stop the North Koreans, they might be down all the way to Busan in the south. And we see that when we look at the Korean War in 1950.
Generally speaking, how important is it for an invader to capture cities?
Very important, because those are strong points of resistance, especially when you're talking about a country that's widely desert. It means that the majority of the population lives in those cities. So if you secure the population centers, it gives the enemy army nowhere to hide, because either they're out in the open where you can pummel them, or they surrender. I mean, if you hold on to the cities. So that's if you're fighting in an urban society. Now, you contrast that with like Afghanistan, you're fighting people in the mountains. It's more important at that point to secure the mountains. So you have to know the terrain. But the problem is the U.S., when they invaded, bypassed all these major cities, which if we were fighting a modern army, they would have just simply severed our supply lines and surrounded our force and destroyed us.
And as you pointed out earlier, the Iraqis fought back successfully in Sadr City and compelled the United States to leave.
Well, ultimately, yeah. I mean, the United States had to rescind control of Sadr City, where from which the Mahdi army, under the control of Muqtada al-Sadr, was able to attack U.S. forces with impunity, because we would not go into Sadr City to chase him.
What is the importance of the attitude of the population, or the qualities in the case of an invasion, that the population of the invaded country?
The attitudes are very important. If they're hostile to the invader, they will help they will act as saboteurs, they will act as guerrillas. In the case when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union, when they went into places like the Ukraine and Belarus, they received a tremendous amount of help from the locals. But then when they invaded Russia proper,
The Germans. A lot of the Ukrainians welcomed the German troops.
The Ukrainians, Latvians, there are actually monuments in Latvia and Lithuania to former Latvian and Lithuanian SS because they despised Stalin. But then when they got into Russia proper, they encountered a lot of guerrillas riding around on horseback attacking German troops. And so the attitude of the populace is very important, which is why there are two attitudes to occupation. Either like the U.S., when the U.S. invaded Germany, there were guerrillas called the Werwolves, the werewolves, and they attacked U.S. forces. They were guerrillas, but ultimately they were compelled to stop fighting because the U.S. said, look, if we leave, the Soviets are going to come in. And the guerrillas went, oh, geez, you know, picking the lesser of two evils at this point. It was either you end up getting conquered by the Americans or the Soviets. There was no good outcome. So they said, well, better to accept the Americans and work with them to keep the Bolsheviks out. Because ultimately, the greatest enemy of the Nazis was the Bolsheviks, not the Western democracies.
It seems like the invader has to weigh in his mind, if I'm pretty decent to the occupied people, like say the Germans were in France, I think the French didn't want to be invaded, but they didn't treat the French like they did the Eastern Europeans and the Russians. If we treat them decently, we're not going to encounter a stronger resistance. And in fact, the French collapsed pretty quickly, whereas the Russians fought like crazy.
Like I say, the Germans told the French, listen, it's either us or the Bolsheviks. And many French, especially because France was a country of culture and aristocrats, because the French had their own problems with socialists. They're looking at the Soviets going, geez, you know, the Soviets have been sponsoring communist revolutions around the world. Would we rather have the Soviets or the Nazis? And the same thing happened in Germany. The other attitude is one of brutality. And that's what the Soviets were masters of, the Russians still today, and what the Chinese are masters of. The idea of, you know, the other guys might treat you better, but if you resist, we'll wipe the floor with you.
As I understand it, when the Russians invaded Germany at the end of World War II, it was their policy to rape German women.
Absolutely.
It wasn't an accident.
It was the policy to rape German women, to shoot members of the Nazi party, to shoot SS men they captured. They were viciously brutal. But the reason was because they felt that if we, and I'm not justifying it, I'm just saying, the reason why they did it is because they felt, well, if we're so brutal, nobody will ever resist. And that's what they did. And then, of course, when they came in, they immediately, as soon as the war ended, ended the policy of rape and abuse. And then they took all the people who had been enemies of the Nazis, all the disenfranchised peasants, and gave them positions of power in the new German Communist Party. So now this would be like, let's say we were invaded by the Chinese and they wiped the floor with us. Well, let's say the Chinese on one side, the Russians on the other, and the Russians would occupy us by saying, well, if it's either us or the Chinese, and the Chinese would occupy us by saying, well, we're so brutal, you can't resist. And additionally, we're going to give important positions of power to, let's say, the Latino community in America, which is largely disenfranchised in many parts of the country, and say, you know what, we're going to make you guys high-ranking members of the Communist Party. So now California, instead of having, let's say, Schwarzenegger as governor, they would have a Latino who was a member of the Communist Party. Well, this is the political
aspect of an occupying force, of an invasion, which is to divide and conquer. You partition the country into entities which are really not sustainable. It's a tactic that the Britain and the United States too has been using around the world, is to fragment countries. That was really called for in an Israeli foreign policy document called the Oded Inyon Plan. And the idea was to fragment the Middle Eastern states into smaller entities that couldn't really be sustainable on their own. But let me ask you this, Marchand. What is the role of militias, of organized home guards, in repelling an invasion? I'm thinking, for example, the home guard in Britain.
Oh, those are essential. Those are absolutely essential, because when you enter a country where people have been disarmed, it is so much easier to occupy them. And, you know, another great example is, why did the Germans meet with so little resistance when they invaded Eastern Europe? One, Stalin was hated. And two, these people had no means to resist. None of them were armed. And people ultimately, at the end of the day, and similarly with Tibet, the Tibetans weren't armed. And people at the end of the day are going to say, look, if they got tanks and I have rocks, what am I going to do? I'm not going to resist. I'm going to let them occupy me. Because ultimately survival is very important. Now, on the other hand, you contrast that with when the British troops were evacuated from Dunkirk. You had the forming of a volunteer force, later on the Home Guard, which became part of, they weren't part of the regular army, but they were ultimately fell under the Ministry of Defense. And they were basically a militia. They were old veterans, guys who were too old to join the army, and they were young boys, and they were given uniforms and guns. And the idea was these men were going to be the first line in the event of invasion. They would defend their towns and villages, and they played a crucial role during the Blitz in helping to evacuate people and helping to rescue people from the rubble and stuff. The Home Guard was essential.
Is it important that this force be well organized as well as armed? Because, for example, in the United States, we have something like 300 million firearms in the hands of American citizens. Would they be effective if they weren't organized?
No. If you look at Britain, the Home Guard was very well organized. You look at Switzerland, everybody owns a gun, but everybody has military training. They can all be called up at any moment. They're all trained. They can all be put into Swiss uniforms again. They all have their uniforms and ready to fight on a moment's notice. Now, you juxtapose that with, let's say, the French Revolution, the July Revolution, most famously depicted in Les Miserables. And what you see a lot of very heavily armed people. No organization. They were anarchists. This was the early years of the rise of communism. And they were inspired a lot by the writings of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. So you have these basically urban educated people who are all very well armed, completely disorganized, not very well trained. And when the French regular army marched in with cannons, they were obliterated. So what you see is that you can have a populace that's very heavily armed, but if people don't know what they're doing, I mean, if you get, let's say, Joe Doakes and his family, and they say, we're going to resist. Well, first of all, how do you get a consensus that everybody's going to resist? How do you get a consensus on how to defend? Because one of the things that you had that was interesting is during World War II, the Germans formed the Volkssturm, which means people's storm. And what they did was, their job was to help resist the Soviets. The problem is they weren't under control of the regular army, the Wehrmacht or the SS. They were under the direct command of Joseph Goebbels, the Minister of Propaganda. And so they operated totally independently of the army and the SS. They got slaughtered on the one hand, and they couldn't be used really effectively because they didn't have enough training.
Well, here you go again, the importance of command and control.
Exactly. And that's part of the problem, is that let's say the Russians or the Chinese were to invade, and we have all these gun owners who are ready to resist, but they don't have military training. They're not organized. They don't have any kind of command structure. You'll see a hodgepodge of spots that resist. The stronger resistance you're going to see in areas with strong community, you know, where everybody knows each other and they all agree, hey, Bob Johnson was a Navy SEAL. Let's put him in charge.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I'm speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marchand McDermott Rowe about military invasions, how they occur, and how a country like the United States could deter or defeat an invasion. In Context website is incontextreport.com, and you can also check us out on Facebook and watch our videos on the In Context Report YouTube channel. Well, let's put this in the context now of the United States. As we discussed earlier, it's been two centuries, the War of 1812, since the U.S. has been invaded. Many Americans believe that an invasion of the U.S. can't happen today, not just because we're a military superpower, but also because any enemy would have to cross the Atlantic Ocean to attack the East, or cross the Pacific Ocean to attack the West Coast of the United States. Does U.S. military strength and our geography make an invasion of the United States impractical today?
No, not at all. What people fail to realize is that the world's smaller. It's so much easier nowadays for an enemy force to cross the ocean than it ever was. Additionally, you have the problem of the fact that our enemies have millions and millions of soldiers. Before, our landmass and our population saved us. The fact that we were a country of 300 million and everybody had guns, we had mountains, we had a lot of troops. Really, like during World War II, the Germans never, not in their wildest dreams, could ever have hoped to, even with the help of the Japanese, could have hoped to occupy the United States. However, if you look at it today, the countries that were really ticking off, the Russians and the Chinese, could field millions of soldiers, particularly the Chinese. They have right now a standing army of 35 million. Contrast that with a U.S. standing army, not including the reserve and the National Guard, of about 1 million, including the reserve and the guard, close to 2 million. It's got 35 million soldiers there. Additionally, the Chinese have the ability to call up close to 380 million young men and women.
And then you have the Russians on the other side.
You also have the problem of the fact that in both these countries, you have millions reaching military age every year. In the case of China, you have close to 20 million men and women, and they draft men and women. You have close to 20 million men and women reaching military age every year, which means that the Chinese really determined to invade, we would have to kill 20 million of them to win a war of attrition every year.
Where would they invade if they were to invade?
They would invade, the Chinese and the Russians, after launching a first strike, paralyze us with a first strike, most likely an EMP attack.
This has knocked out the command and control.
Knock out the command and control and communications. You would hit the urban centers. You would also hit along the highways. So areas like New York, D.C. would be crucial because highways are very important for invaders as they are for defenders.
So they would actually want to land troops near highways?
Absolutely, because you control the cities. Now you can move your troops along the highways. The Germans use the Autobahn during their invasions of Europe to transport troops. We then use the Autobahn during our invasion to advance troops inland. And so highways are very important. Bridges are very important. One of the things the Swiss realized is all of their bridges are rigged with explosives. So that on a moment's notice, if an enemy invades, the Swiss generals can say, we're blowing up this bridge, and this bridge. So now the invaders have to stop.
And of course, it's a very mountainous country.
Exactly. We don't have explosives on our bridges. Additionally, if you paralyze our command and control, people wouldn't take the initiative to blow the bridges either. There also would be the hope that if we repel the invader, we're going to want to use the bridges to keep going so they can't stop us. Our highways are part of our vulnerability. And so they would invade along highway routes. You know, you wouldn't see them landing in the middle of the Mojave Desert.
Okay, they land on the coast near highway routes. They move along highways, presumably to capture the important cities?
Exactly, because they know that it would be a complete morale blow to the United States. They also know that most of our population is in the cities. They also know that most of our military forces are not in the cities. First of all, knocking out our military installations would not be that hard because they're far away from population centers. They tend to be isolated, so they'd be relatively easy to encircle and destroy. They're also not in defensible positions.
Well, this is an interesting point you just alluded to. Most of our bases are not located for strategic purposes.
Absolutely not. They used to be.
But now they're really located because Congressman so-and-so needs the jobs in his district.
Exactly. And that's part of the problem. Let's say if you were to look at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, it's located in the middle of the flipping woods.
So it's not defending any significant
resource
of America.
It's not defending St. Louis. St. Louis could fall, and then they could, you know, and they could easily surround and isolate Fort Leonard Wood, preventing them from moving troops up.
And such troops as we have, most of them now are deployed abroad. At one of our 700 or more military bases.
And that's the other thing that I think people fail to realize is that we couldn't launch a counterattack from abroad because this would very likely be coordinated with attacks on South Korea by the North Koreans. This might be coordinated with attacks by the Iranians and the Syrians on U.S. and Israeli forces in the Middle East. So this would be a blitzkrieg attack on all fronts. So we couldn't just pull our troops home at the last minute to defend the mainland, like when Rome started to fall and the Romans started pulling their legions back from Britain and Gaul and places like that to defend Rome. That wouldn't be happening.
What's the status of the U.S. coastline defenses today?
There aren't any coastline defenses. We have no early warning system. We have no coastline defenses. Our coasts are completely vulnerable. We have no anti-aircraft missile batteries set up along our coast. We have no way to warn our population. I talked to a friend of mine many years ago who was in military intelligence, and I asked him, how much warning would we have if let's say, an enemy submarine were to launch an attack on a major American city? He said about 30 seconds. Now, contemplate this for a minute. They don't need to drop nuclear ordnance. Let's say just an EMP attack would paralyze us, but let's say conventional ordnance for the sake of argument. A ballistic missile like the Bulava launched from a Borei-class Russian submarine, the stealth submarine, if they were to launch one of those, 10 warheads hit 10 major American cities with a conventional high-explosive ordnance that just like sets
so one missile launched from this submerged Russian submarine could launch. One missile has 10 warheads?
Yep. And so, and let's,
each independently guided?
Each independently guided with its own countermeasures, too. So let's say these 10 warheads hit 10 major American cities along the East Coast, and you use incendiary explosives. Well, first of all, you'd have rip-roaring fires throughout the city. And let's look at recent events. Let's look at Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Sandy. You have the entirety of the United States Federal Emergency Management Agency paralyzed because of a hurricane. Now imagine if you were to have 10 cities pounded with high explosives, or an EMP attack that fried our electrical grid even just on the East Coast. The United States, and they've seen this, our enemies watch this, they know we would not be able to respond to a disaster of this magnitude. We would not be able to set up refugee camps. We would not be able to organize rescue efforts. We would not be able to, we have trouble controlling one disaster in one city at a time, let alone if you had 10 at once, and that's just from one warhead. Imagine if this thing carries about a dozen of these missiles, a dozen missiles, each with 10 warheads. That's 120 warheads, meaning you can independently target 120 targets from one submarine at one time.
So that would typically precede the landing of enemy troops on our coastline.
Exactly.
Now, what steps could the U.S. take to either deter or resist an invasion?
Well, firstly, it would be to strengthen our military, have a bigger military. All these defense budget cuts, looks, it sounds really nice, but the fact is they're still sending money to the contractors. They're just cutting the number of troops. Get rid of the contractors, hire more soldiers, train our soldiers better, and set up our bases at strategic locations. Another thing, start installing warning system, early warning systems. Start preparing our emergency services for what will happen if there's an invasion and you can't get help from FEMA.
What do you specifically need to defend your coastline? Let's say there are lots of landing ships off your coastline. What kind of weapons do you need to keep the enemy from landing?
You need bunkers established. You need to have the ability for your National Guard to immediately entrench. You also should have plans on the books. You don't need to have these things built.
What about artillery to sink those ships?
Having artillery would be important, but this would be part of it, because if their first strike is successful, we probably won't be able to hit their ships.
So does
it pay
for us to
involve them? At that point, stopping them on the beach.
Does it pay for us at this point as part of an anti-invasion deterrence program to have a lot of batteries along our coast?
Yes. Your goal is not to sink the enemy ships with those batteries. Your goal is, like at Normandy, destroy the troops on the beaches. What you need to do is have plans. You need to have bunkers built in many cases. You need to have bunkers built and established. You also need to have plans on the books so that your National Guard at a moment's notice can dig trenches and build defensive networks and set up the artillery so that inland just enough so that when the enemy hits the beaches, you can hammer them before they can move inland. Because once they move inland, it's all
over.
Now,
you mentioned before that the Russians and the Chinese, I believe, have these new generation of silent submarines that can launch guided missiles while moving underwater. Do we have comparable submarines, and do we need them?
We need them, yes, because we need to have, that's part of the deterrent, is showing the Russians and the Chinese that, A, we can seek out and destroy your submarines, and we can hit you at home. You might land troops here, but we can still hit Beijing and Moscow. Right now, as it stands, our missiles are inferior to the new missile defense system that the Russians have set up to defend against our missiles. The other thing that we have to also do, we need to be prepared to call up the citizenry to defend the country. And we need to be prepared to, again, repel troops that are landing in landing craft. We need to be prepared.
Well, what about cities? You talked about, say, the Iranians with their entrenchments around the cities that the Iraqis were attacking. Should we have plans to dig entrenchments
what I was just talking about before, is that the National Guard needs to have plans on the books written up so that on a moment's notice, if suddenly the electronics stop working and they realize something's wrong, the general in charge of the New York City National Guard can call on his men and they start building barricades and digging trenches in crucial locations.
And they have to know, they have to pre-plan where those locations are.
That's what I'm saying.
And I would suppose have a supply of concrete or barbed wire, whatever they need to make those effective.
Exactly. They need to have stockpiled concrete, concertina wire, shovels, sandbags. They need to be ready on a moment's notice to start digging trenches and setting up barricades.
You mentioned earlier about the EMP bomb disabling electronics. Is there a way to harden your equipment against that attack?
There is. In fact, and this is the sad thing, according to popular science, it would cost $100 million to harden the entire military and national security infrastructure and emergency services. That's not including regular civilians, but that's just your emergency services and your military. $100 million. We give more in aid to Israel and Egypt every year. And we spend more on these flipping drones, getting them developed, than it would cost us to harden our infrastructure. Really, ignoring this threat, it is farcical. It really is farcical. We're ignoring the fact that our enemies could launch a first strike on us, because part of the problem is that this has so far, since the fall of the Soviet Union, disappeared from our collective conscience, that when you talk to people about it, they go, that could never happen.
Well, our military includes a National Guard, which I think a lot of people thought of as to help out with the home defense or to aid civilians in natural disasters. Do we need perhaps some kind of a territorial army that's not deployable abroad that would be organized and tasked with the mission of defending the United States in the case of an invasion?
Absolutely. And I think the reserve and the guard should be merged into a territorial army. The reserve and the National Guard are becoming redundant. They're being used the same as the active duty army. They need to expand the size of the active duty army if they want to keep having troops abroad, but they need to establish a territorial army, merge the National Guard and the reserve together, and allow the National Guard generals to operate independently. So if communications with Washington goes down, any general in charge of a National Guard force, whether it's the state of Connecticut or New Hampshire, Vermont, California, Idaho, et cetera, can mobilize their troops and immediately start setting up defenses and barricades.
And these new military organizations, this territorial force, would be organized locally, I would guess, because right now there are people in the reserves who travel 50 miles or more to go to their reserve meetings. Would these units be more based in their towns?
Absolutely. You would want a unit of some description in every town. So whether it's, okay, we're going to have a small supply unit in this town because it's a small town, or we're going to have, you know, it's a big town like Hartford or New Haven or Boston, we're going to have several units in that town, that's perfectly fine. But you need to have local units so, A, people can get to their armories quickly. They can get to their unit quickly. I mean, as it stands, let's say your reserve unit is 75 miles from where you live, which is not unheard of. For a lot of guys, it is. And your armory is 75 miles from where you live. If the enemy launches a first strike, you're never going to get there. You're never going to get there in time. You'll have time to put on your uniform, but you'll never get up there, because what will happen is the highways will be crammed with traffic and you'll never make it to your unit.
So you want to have a mobilization site that's near your house. And it seems to me another advantage would be that the people in the unit would know each other and they'd know the area they were defending, which I would think would be an advantage.
Which is a sad thing, is that the North Koreans do this and we don't. The British do this and we don't. North Korean special forces units are based in the towns they're from. And the reason is because this way, if you're attacked, nobody knows the town better than you. And similarly with the British territorials and the British regular army, they're all based locally. So you're from, let's say, Yorkshire, you would join a Yorkshire rifle company. You're from Glasgow, you would join a Highlander unit based in Glasgow. The idea being that if you're invaded, you know that city. You know that city. You can defend the city.
We're just about out of time here, Marshawn, in this discussion. I want to thank you very much. Do you have any final thoughts?
My final thoughts is that we ignore these threats at our own peril. This isn't just spouting out fear-mongering, you know, as some people have said. You know, it's to bury your head in the sand is not thinking sensibly. To be aware of the fact that your house is on a fault line is not fear-mongering. To be aware of the fact that a forest fire might be heading towards your house is not fear-mongering. It's common sense.
Well, thank you very much, Marshawn. You've been listening to In Context War Report. I'm your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe, and I've been speaking with In Context military affairs commentator Marshawn McDermott-Rowe about military invasions. how they occur, and how a country like the United States could deter or defeat an invasion. In Context is produced by MDR Productions, Inc., and is broadcast on non-commercial, listener-sponsored WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and streams at WPKN.org. We thank you listeners very much for your generous contributions to WPKN, which keeps this community station independent and strong. In Context programs are archived for free listening at incontextreport.com and WPKN.org. Thanks for joining us on In Context. See you next time.